Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. I'm here today with Anna Myers, our co-producer. And today we've got a returning guest, a visitor, Julie O'Donohue, sat in on a couple of interviews we had, I think it was in January. And she was on her way to South Africa to on an assignment. Julie's a graduate of Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. She went to Johannesburg to work for Business Day. Is that correct?
Yes, that's good.
So thought we'd bring her in because working at a publication in another country, I thought she might have an interesting perspective on, you know, what journalism is like in other countries. And thanks to social media and email, we were able to sort of stay in contact while she was in Africa. And I asked her, you know, if she could interview some journalists there to get their perspective on what's going on in South Africa as far as journalism goes. And we'll be playing a little bit of those interviews after we talk for a little bit. But tell us about South Africa, your experience working there. What did you learn? You know, what impressed you the most about being there?
Sure. I guess I'll start with what impressed me. South Africa's only been a democracy for 19 years, and it's really only had a free press since 1990. Before that, it was heavily censored. The apartheid government didn't let the press report on a lot of things. So I was pretty impressed with how professional and how much like the American media that was. You know, I didn't really notice that much of a difference between newsrooms I've worked in here and the newsroom there in terms of how they covered the government and how they went about covering business as usual.
So it was Business Day. I assume it was an industry sort of focused paper?
It's modeled after the Financial Times, and so I would say the closest comparison would be the Wall Street Journal here. It's a national newspaper, but they do cover Johannesburg more closely because they're based there, and they do a lot of financial news.
So what were the big stories that were going on while you were there?
Well, Oscar Pistorius was definitely biggest story that was going on when I was there. Pretoria, where Oscar Pistorius lives and where the incident took place is like an hour north of where I am, Joburg. The other big story is the budget came out, the country's budget came out. And unlike here where states have like their own budget and kind of a lot of control, in South Africa, the country's budget covers everything, like all education spending, you know, for elementary school, kindergarten stuff. That was a big story while I was there. The president spent 200 million rand, which is about $20 million, to upgrade his personal residence and to make it more secure. He has four wives and about 24 children that people know of. So his situation and how much money was being spent on his security and his family was a huge story there. $20 million in South Africa is an enormous amount of money.
Was that part of the country's budget, or is that a separate
item?
It's interesting. In the Constitution in South Africa, the president, it's stated that the president's family is going to be protected and taken care of by the South African government. I don't know why that is. I don't think that that's in our Constitution, to my knowledge. But so there is this issue of, like, he has four wives, and polygamy is legal in South Africa, although neither Nelson Mandela or the previous president, there have only been three, had multiple wives. Yeah. So this is like a new thing for them. And they are obligated to take care of them and their children. But some people thought that this was extreme, I guess would be the word. I mean, I think he built a personal hospital on his compound. And there are no
Obamacare there. No, he's not.
No. And like the security measures taken were kind of extreme. Honestly, that story had broken right before I got there, but it was sort of an ongoing issue. A lot of people were really appalled. I mean, like everyone from like taxi drivers to, you know, CEOs of companies commented on this when you talked to them about how the country is going through a really bad time financially, and the president was spending all this money on himself. And there are three official residences, like the White House, he has three homes. Mm-hmm. But this is like his home. Like it would be if Obama spent $20 million on his home in Chicago, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, upgrading it.
Yeah, that
and
wouldn't
stuff.
Fly somehow,
right.
I don't think.
Correct.
So the I know I'm going to mispronounce the name. Pistorius?
Pistorius, yeah.
Pistorius. Now, you're on social media, and you saw how it was playing here. What are your observations on how it played here as opposed to how it sort of played there? Was there much different?
Yeah, actually, I thought it was very interesting how different it was. So, first of all, Oscar Pistorius to South Africa is a huge deal.
It's maybe like the Michael Jordan in
Tiger Woods.
Yeah, definitely like the Tiger Woods. He's in every Nike ad you see. I think the fact that he is a disabled athlete also rings or sort of resonates with South Africans a lot because, you know, South Africa feels like they were hobbled for a long time with apartheid. And so the fact that this person's able to overcome all these things and they're South African kind of...
Mm-hmm. It's symbolic.
Yeah, it's symbolic. It's also symbolic, I would say, to the white South African community, too, because they feel like they don't have a lot of positive role models out there in the world that people are turning to and saying, oh, we admire that person for what they've done. Mm-hmm. The thing I noticed about the States and coverage, I think that this makes sense, is that because it happened so close to Newtown and while the gun debate was going on here, that there was a lot of focus on why Oscar had a gun, mm-hmm. that South Africans have so many guns, why personal security issues and kind of relating it to the States debate. I think in South Africa has a lot of problems with violence, and it's kind of, if you will, random violence. A lot of people in Johannesburg, you don't walk down the street. You drive down the street to your local drugstore. You probably live in a house that has a 17 or 18-foot wall around it with barbed wire, if you can afford that. And middle-class people live that way. It's not just, like, really wealthy people. Mm-hmm. And so... I think it was more of a given in South Africa that, you know, he would have a gun.
Yeah.
And once it came out how many guns he had, people started to think, this is kind of a gun nut. But, like, before that, I don't think it was considered that shocking that he would live in sort of a fortress. Like, mm-hmm. people in the U.S. kept saying he lives in a fortress. But almost anyone of means, and even people who are middle class or I would say, like, on the higher end of working class, live mm-hmm. in their own personal fortress in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Just crime is a really big problem and fear of home invasion is a big problem. Mm-hmm. A lot of people I know have been either the victims of violent crime themselves or someone in their family had been. And that includes, you know, rape, being beaten up, or having someone killed in mm-hmm. your family. I mean, it's kind of shocking how people live there.
Mm-hmm. It's odd that, you know, the way, you know, sort of what you were talking about with the Newtown shootings and everything, of trying to relate, you know, again, you know, America's, I don't know if it's our jingoistic journalism where we view events that are going on around the world through from our perspective of what we're dealing with day to day in America, where the situation may be very, or is probably very different in another country and will be played and look very different there.
Yeah. Now, South Africa has a big issue, I would say, with violence against women. And so that came into play a lot more with the discussion about Oscar and whether he killed his girlfriend because, you know, they were in a domestic dispute or, you know, whether he did it by accident, as he's claiming.
Mm-hmm.
That brought up a lot of discussion, like even on things like Drive Time Radio, they were saying things like, how do we relate to each other better as men and women? Mm. I mean, you know, there were pretty serious discussions around that front, which was interesting because I think sometimes that situation with violence against women in South Africa doesn't necessarily get talked about as if it's the whole community. Sometimes it's relegated to being a issue in the black community.
Mm-hmm. Or a socioeconomic thing.
Right.
It's this group has that, but that's not a problem across.
For sure. But this seemed to open up a big discussion about that. Now, I don't know if that was going on before, but it certainly talked about like how, you know, from male DJs and commercial radio journalists, like how can we treat our women better
mm-hmm.
to, you know, how should you treat women?
Right.
And that previously had mostly, I think, been discussed about in and about the black community. The president and his four wives, certainly that's come up with him before. But there was definitely a lot more talk about that, whereas I don't think in the U.S. that wasn't brought up as much that, oh, South Africa has a problem with violence against women.
So what about – let's go back to your job, your day-to-day. What was it you were doing there at Business Day?
I was working in the video department. So I was doing video for the web in the multimedia department. Business Day is the first newspaper in South Africa to have a video department. They are, I would say, light years ahead of other newspapers in South Africa in terms of trying to do new media. Their website is much better than any other paper I saw there. And some of that's because their demographics are such, just like the Wall Street Journal.
Business people.
It's business people. It's people who are affluent, who are plugged in, who definitely have a smartphone, if not an iPad, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was interesting. You know, they're still trying to get their feet kind of under them in terms of video. It's a financial publication, so some things don't lend themselves to visual storytelling that much.
Right.
But I really applaud them for putting it out there and doing it. I should explain that broadband in South Africa is really expensive. Mm-hmm. People pay by the gigabyte, if not the megabyte. Everyone does. So, like, even if you're a very wealthy person, if you're looking at your smartphone, it's a decision to watch a video because you're going to be using 50 megabytes that you could use on something else to watch that video. So the fact that they even have a video department is pretty impressive. It shows that they're like kind of looking towards
forward
the future.
Thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. Because right now, I mean, people in South Africa do not watch like funny cat videos on their phone
because it's too expensive.
Right. They're paying for that. Yeah. I mean, my friends, my peers who are in their late 20s, early 30s told me next to their rent, their data plan for their phone or for their computer was the most expensive item in their budget. More than food.
Right.
I mean, so whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it shows you that it's like,
and that's what we have to deal with in America, the relative cheapness of broadband.
We're
balancing the fact that we're able to do all this stuff, but then we've load up what we're watching. We're wasting our time more with cat videos and stuff like
right.
that.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not making smart decisions about spending that time. Well, why don't we at this point sort of adjourn? Oh, you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
I have a question.
Can you just talk briefly about your background?
Yeah, sure. Well, before I went to Medill at Northwestern, I worked for a community newspaper in D.C. called the Northwest Current, which was a lovely experience, but was totally print-based. I mean, they did not even have a website for a while while I was there. And then they kind of only got one for advertising purposes. And then I went and worked with Mike at The Connection out in Northern Virginia. And I covered the county government in Fairfax primarily. So both the Board of Supervisors out there and the school board.
And you covered elections and stuff like that and some media stories as well.
Yeah. Yeah, some statewide stuff. It was a good time to be there because – you know, Obama made a play for Virginia fairly about a year after I got there, 2 years. So
yeah, and you know, a year after you got there, you interviewed Obama, you covered Sarah Palin and John McCain, and you saw everybody, and that was a fun time.
Yeah. So and I'm sort of still connected to Virginia News in that there's a nonprofit in Virginia called the Virginia Public Access Project. I put together their email news blast in the morning, so like articles from the Virginian Pilot and the Richmond Times-Dispatch and other papers around Virginia, they kind of compile them and send them out to people who might be interested in what's going on around the state.
And that's a real interesting organization. They're the ones who also do the election finance data?
Yeah, they do campaign finance, and they do a lot of like – when new lobbyists register, that all goes up on their website so you can see who's hiring what lobbyists, how many lobbyists does Dominion Power have at this point, or Altria, which is the old Philip Morris.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great resource for journalists and also for just people who want to stay informed about what their candidates, you know, who's giving them money. You know, if you're running for any office in Virginia, pretty much, you know, from the mayor up to the governor, they have all the information about who they, you know, because all the stuff that those candidates have to file with the election board, with their finance. That's hugely important and interesting. I'd love to see that proliferate.
So just to wrap up that question. So what took you digital? What made you decide to go that direction?
So I decided to go to grad school because I wanted to learn how to better work across platforms. Mike was already in grad school.
Yeah.
And I was there with him.
Yes.
And far ahead of me on that front. But I wanted to learn how to work across platforms. And I think I don't want to necessarily turn this into a plug for Northwestern, but I think they did a pretty good job. I mean, I knew nothing about HTML and CSS.
I heard you. I remember you complaining about it.
Yeah.
But it was like, you just wait, because once you get on the other end of it, you'll be so happy. Yeah.
And I learned how to edit audio. I certainly took a few classes in video, and I went to South Africa through Northwestern, and I told them I wanted to do video when I was abroad because I felt like I wanted to get an idea of how that worked, and I felt like I needed more practice, mm-hmm. and it was definitely good for me.
Okay. Well, let's pause this, and we're going to listen to the interviews you did. Who are the people you spoke to?
His name is Anton Harber. He's the head of the journalism school at the University of, I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly, Witwatersrand. Everyone calls it Wits. It is one of the very top universities in South Africa. He, I think, started the journalism program there, and he was the editor and founder of a newspaper that's now called The Mail and Guardian that actually probably resembles more like a Newsweek or a Time mm-hmm. here. It's a weekly newspaper. The articles are a little bit longer, but it's highly regarded. It was my favorite newspaper in South Africa, mm-hmm. you know, with all due respect to Business Day. So, and it was an anti-apartheid newspaper under apartheid. It got shut down a couple times. It was sort of operating. He called it alternative press. It's not quite like our alternative press, but it was operating in a way that was angering
right.
the powers
it was,
that be.
It was confrontational right. to whatever the powers.
Right.
Okay, so let's take a listen to this.
So my name is Anton Harber. I'm currently something called the Caxton Professor of Journalism at the University of the Witwatersrand, which is the leading university in Johannesburg, where I run the journalism school, the journalism department. I'm a former newspaper editor. I was the founding editor of a newspaper now called The Mail and Guardian, used to be called The Weekly Mail. What else can I tell you that's relevant? I'm chairman of an organization called the Freedom of Expression Institute. So I'm a freedom of expression activist. I'm the author of a book called Deep Sluit. I'm a columnist for various papers, including returning quite soon to Business Day.
I was wondering if you could talk about how, you know, in general, what you think the state of freedom of expression is in South Africa, how it's changed.
In fact, we have a remarkable degree of freedom of expression, a very high level of it, and we've had since Mandela left prison in 1990. We've really been very free to do much as we want to do without fear of closure or arrest or prosecution. The reason there's been a growing controversy around it is because there has been a threat to freedom of expression, which has taken two forms. It's the one has been the government calling for a statutory media tribunal. To end the system of self-regulation we have in the printed media in particular, because they've been very critical of some of the print media's attitudes and reporting.
So that would be they would be able to prosecute journalists for...
Well, it's not clear what they mean by it, but we've had a British-style self-regulatory system in this country for many decades. And they're suggesting that there be an appeal board that is statutorily recognized. I suppose something like where Britain is moving to, but there's a very strong resistance here to statutory regulation of that sort. And the other threat has been that they've tabled and they've and put down a number of versions of a what we call a secrecy bill, a protection of state information bill that deals with whistleblowers and leaks from the state and security information. That's a bad law. I mean, it was 2 years ago in their first table. It was a terrible law. There's been a lot of resistance to it, to the point where it hasn't been approved by Parliament yet. But even the version they're looking at now is much improved. It's still a bad law, but it still hasn't been passed. So there is a threat from the government to start to limit the freedom of expression we've had. But on the other hand, there's been very strong resistance to it. And that's been a very healthy sign.
You said that freedom of expression came into sort of being, you know, I'm assuming in the early, mid-90s.
Well, in 1990, and then of course it was entrenched in the new constitution in 94.
Okay, can you talk about what restrictions existed before 1990?
We had very heavy censorship in the days of apartheid before 1990. Broadcasting was very tightly state-controlled. There were a number of laws limiting what we could say, who we could quote, particularly of banned political organizations like the ANC and people like Nelson Mandela. In particular, during the 1980s, there was a series of states of emergencies because of the uprising that was happening at the time, which brought in a lot of quite severe media restrictions. So, for example, the paper I worked on, the Weekly Mail, was closed down for a period. It was. I mean, our paper was closed down. Some of our journalists and certainly some other journalists and editors were detained for very long periods of time. We were prosecuted many times for writing stuff they didn't want us to write. So it was very... It was tightly controlled.
So can you give me an example of something that you all wrote that caused you to be shut down or someone put in?
Well, the reason we were shut down was they said that we were promoting the aims of banned organizations and that we were undermining the security forces during the state of emergency. So we were reporting on what they were doing, and obviously they didn't want that.
Right.
But basically, the Weekly Mail then was a very strong anti-apartheid newspaper, very outspoken and quite cheeky in doing it. So it bumped heads with the authorities repeatedly during that period.
So how did that transition work, I mean, from a journalism perspective?
Well, what happened was all those restrictions in 1990 effectively fell away, although many of them were still on the statute books. They were just not being implemented. So that period of 19 to 94 was one of complete freedom, because really there was no authority over what one did in the media. And we were like deer caught in the headlights. We suddenly had all this incredible freedom. And, you know, we'd learnt and developed ways, and sometimes I think quite imaginative and creative ways, to deal with censorship and to cope and fight censorship and undermine censorship. But suddenly we found ourselves approaching a normal situation where we had to relearn to be normal journalists and use our freedom effectively. So we went through a very difficult transition. And a very complicated transition, in which most papers like the Weekly Mail, because the Weekly Mail then was one of a number of what we called alternative publications,
sure,
anti-apartheid publications, non-mainstream publications at the time, all of them except the Weekly Mail closed down in the transition because they couldn't really cope or find an audience or find financial backing in the transitional period. Then came the Constitution in 1994, and that sort of obviously it gave huge protection to freedom of expression, but it also, you know, started to create a balance between freedom of expression and people's rights to privacy and dignity and the normal constitutional issues in a constitutional democracy. And we've been grappling with those since then, really, to try and establish, I suppose, a new set of rules and norms. The ANC government has certainly felt that the media has been very critical, and they would argue, as a whole, has been hostile to the transition project and hostile to the ANC government. I think that's contestable, but it's one of the reasons they've pushed for change and transformation and action on the media front.
I just want to kind of figure out what you mean about being like imaginative, or what type of adjustments or difficulties you would have in sort of the transition period.
Well, the strange thing about censorship here is it fell within a legal framework, by and large. So they would pass a law saying you can't quote such and such a person because they're a banned person. So you would use approaches like quoting that person's spouse or quoting them without naming them and giving hints as to who they were. And so we saw our mission in that era as finding creative ways to get around censorship, to keep people informed as best we could by looking for the grey areas of the law. The way censors worked and usually work is they don't create hard and fast rules, they create areas of uncertainty to try and intimidate you into self-censorship. And you can sometimes use those to push back the law.
Sure. So is that why, like, when you go to, like, the Apartheid Museum and stuff, you see, like, a lot of footage of someone like Winnie Mandela? Or was she banned? I don't know.
She was banned for periods of time, but there were periods when she was one of the sole people who could speak out.
Okay.
In a sense, for her husband and for the ANC. And periods where she could be quoted and periods when she couldn't. And these things changed all the time.
Okay.
One of the best known things we did, for example, was at the height of the state emergency, when they really were very severely restricted in our reporting on security force action in particular. And we decided we would produce a newspaper as if there were no restrictions. And then we got our lawyer to tell us what had to come out, and we simply put black lines. So you've got a whole newspaper with black lines and pictures blacked out, dotted throughout the paper. Except I think, I don't think there was anything on the sports pages. I think we managed to keep those clean.
So can I ask you, in terms of the transition, I mean, it sounds like, you know, obviously you were in one camp of media, but for someone, a publication that was more mainstream, or certainly something like the SABC, which I'm going to explain to the audience is the public station.
It was then a state broadcaster.
Right.
Didn't serve the public, it served the state and the ruling party.
I mean, what do you have a sense of what their transition was like?
It was, theirs was maybe the biggest transition of all, because they were a state broadcaster serving the ruling party and very tightly controlled. They moved quickly to become a public broadcaster, ran at arm's length from the state, and with a new public broadcasting mandate to serve the public. A very difficult transition, because also, and it was true of most of our newsrooms, were overwhelmingly white. Most of them, not all of them. Some were partly mixed, and some black newspapers had blacker newsrooms, but the SABC newsroom was largely white, and that had to go through a very quick and very radical transition to a more representative demographic.
I know now they broadcast in multiple languages.
They always did. They always did, but then it was very much used as an instrument of separation. So they were very strict about different languages on different stations and no crossover. Whereas now they broadcast in all languages, but they're much more relaxed about moving between languages on stations. It's no longer that kind of pure attempt to divide people by language or by ethnicity.
Outside of SABC, in terms of private media companies, were there concerns about who owned the media?
Very definitely, because ownership was very tightly held. So we had, in the printed media, we had an Afrikaans press, which was also very close to the ruling party.
Okay.
And it's had to go through a huge transition as the ruling part, that ruling party lost power. In the English press, the mining houses really controlled the English language press, the mainstream press, that is, and it was quite a conservative liberal press. So it was an anti-apartheid press, but strictly within the limits of white politics. And they had to go through their own, a less radical transition, but a transition as well. Outside of broadcasting, there's issues about language, because we have 11 official languages, but we really only produce major newspapers in three of those 11 languages. The press has always been predominantly English and Afrikaans,
right?
And we've had growth in recent years in isiZulu, the Zulu language.
Okay.
But the other languages are really quite dramatically underrepresented in the printed media.
And SABC I think its biggest radio station is a Zulu radio station.
By a long way, the biggest station is the Zulu station. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And can you kind of explain, like, that people speak Afrikaans across? I think some Americans might think that Afrikaans is only spoken by white South Africans, and that's not true.
No, it's pretty widely understood.
Okay.
It's spoken. It's certainly the leading language in the coloured population.
Sure.
The mixed race and the Malaysian descent population. That we call the coloured population, and it's widely understood by a lot of South Africans. English, the most common languages are English, Afrikaans, and Zulu.
Okay.
The most widely understood.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
But most South Africans speak 3, 4, 5 languages.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to get back to what you were saying about integrating newsrooms, because I think that's something we struggle with in the U.S. And in the U.S., I would say that I think newspapers in particular are still having struggles sort of having a diverse staff. There's a little bit more pressure on certainly television. You know, I'm from Washington, D.C. Our market has a large black population, so I mean there are you see prominent black faces on our nightly news, and if you didn't, I'd question what was going on there. But so I wanted to talk a little bit about what happened in South Africa, because I feel like at Business Day, I mean, things aren't perfect, but you know, I work in a department with all black journalists. And I feel like, you know, there is some representation. I know the demographics here are vastly different.
No, it's changed dramatically, and most newsrooms now are much more representative than they were 15 years ago. 15 years ago, it ranged from newsroom to newsroom. Some were completely white. Some were integrated, some were completely black, and those were the newspapers really aimed at a purely black audience.
Yeah.
But certainly, overwhelmingly, the management and editing positions, the senior positions, were overwhelmingly white. And clearly that had to change quite quickly. And there was huge pressure for that change, because I think quite rightly people saw the media not just... You know, it was true of almost every South African workplace had to go through a huge transition,
sure,
particularly in management. But the media was seen as particularly important because, in a way, it's a social leader. It's a,
right.
It has a very particular role in, you know, in a society in transition. So it was seen as a priority to bring transformation. And, you know, transformation is defined in many ways, but clearly the first priority was simply a more representative demography in the newsrooms and in newspaper management and control. And it was a difficult transition. A lot of skills and experience were lost as, I suppose, white males either left journalism or were retired early or left the country. A lot of new young people came in and because it was a rapid transition, it affected the quality of our media naturally to go through a change like that and a loss of experience and skills. It's going to affect things, but I think we've come out the other end. We're suffering from many of the same issues and ailments that journalism is suffering around the world.
Sure.
So there's a very mixed state of journalism in this country. But it's certainly that level of transition in terms of the demography of newsrooms. We've come a long way down the line.
So now that we've covered that, I mean, I guess I want to get back to, I guess, what sounds like a little bit of a backlash that's going on right now in terms of wanting to, I guess, scale back the expression of freedom, or at least in some corners. Can you talk about where, like, specifically that's coming from? I mean, is that coming from President Zuma? Is that coming from...
It's coming from strong elements within the ANC, who feel, you know, and it comes from two strains. The one is there is a feeling that in exercising its freedom, the media has sometimes trampled on people's rights to dignity and privacy. Dignity being a particularly sensitive issue in a country coming from apartheid, you know. But also a sense that the media has been very critical of the ANC. And it's true, the media has been very critical of the ANC. I think that's quite a healthy thing, but clearly, I suppose you have to understand that we had a liberation movement that became a government in a swift transition, a very difficult transition, and often felt the difficult scrutiny of a very critical media.
We should probably explain that the ANC is the ruling party by a fairly sizable majority.
Well, I think that's clearly a factor, because the ANC, you know, it's commanded two-thirds support, roughly, since it came to power, and with a fairly weak opposition. So at least elements of the press have seen a need to, in a sense, step into that gap and be particularly strong on it. If there's a strength in the media in this country, it's that certain papers have been very strong watchdogs.
Which papers?
I would say the Mail and Guardian, what was the Weekly Mail. I would say the Sunday Times, in particular periods, not consistently, but certainly in recent years. What has been strong in this country, very noticeably, I think, is investigative journalism. You know, I know around the world, investigative journalism has been in decline in many places because of the costs and the financial situation. But in this country, there are three or four very strong, top quality, by any international standard, investigative teams that have been powerful watchdogs at the Mail and Guardian, at the Sunday Times. Television program like Carte Blanche on Mnet has done some very good stuff. City Press, most recently. And, you know, I've been a judge in international competitions for investigative journalism and for local. And our good investigative journalism can compete with anything in the world.
It's hard for me to tell how the digital revolution has hit South Africa or not hit South Africa. Do you think it's hitting the media? Are you guys at the... I mean, it does seem that you all are a little bit, in terms of the impact on the industry, behind where the U.S. is.
Oh, yes. Bandwidth here has been slow and expensive. very expensive.
It's very expensive to use bandwidth. It is not. I mean, most of my friends pay for data plans. They tell me it's their biggest expense next to their their rent. Yeah. Whereas in the U.S., we pay like a flat fee. And
So that delayed the impact on the traditional media, and certainly from you know, and certainly newspapers in between about the year 2002 and 2009 or 10, there was growth in our newspapers.
There was growth. Why?
Largely because we had a new generation of tabloids emerge. Which found new readers, and the reading market expanded. And because the internet was only a factor in a small percentage, maybe 10% of the population. That pattern has shifted in the last couple of years. Newspapers have gone into quite serious decline. And I think the clearest explanation for that is that mobile access to the internet has taken off. It's still expensive, but it's got a little bit cheaper. And the big change has been the arrival of smartphones and the fact that a lot of young people are accessing the internet with limited usage because of the cost, but accessing it online.
Okay. And so you feel like most, like for example, most people that would be reading a newspaper probably also are... have a smartphone or a mobile device that they're looking at stuff on. Yes.
I mean, smartphones are cell phones are ubiquitous in this country, and increasingly it's smartphones, which has enabled an access that that many people didn't have because they didn't have a PC.
Sure.
And they didn't have a telephone, or particularly a high bandwidth telephone line, a broadband line. So many more people can access it now, but usage is still limited by the cost.
Gotcha. Has the broadcast media been hit hard by the digital?
Look, our biggest media, our most popular media, is still radio.
Okay.
So, you know, 92% of the population listen to radio, and that remains, you know, and television is somewhere about 60-65%.
Okay.
So print has been hard hit and the others less so.
Okay. But you guys aren't, it doesn't seem like you're at the point yet here where people are watching like AFCON on their phone, right?
No.
Okay.
No, because of the bandwidth cost.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. So, given that you're kind of looking ahead, do you see things going the way they've gone in the States and the UK in terms of like where the media industry is going to be in a few years? Do you think you're moving that direction too?
You know, predicting.
Sure.
Predicting what happens with our media is a fool's game.
Right.
if we've learned anything in the transitions, in the media transitions of the last 20 years, it's avoid predictions.
Sure.
I think there are differences in this country because, in a sense, we're going to leapfrog to mobile access and not go through the stage of desktop access quite as much. Most of our access is workplace-based, much more so than home-based. Which means different usage patterns. So people, biggest usage is at lunchtime in offices rather than evenings as it is in the US, for example.
Yeah.
I understand. So there clearly are differences that we still, you know, grappling to understand what the impact will be.
Okay.
But newspapers here have never had huge penetration. You have to understand that the newspaper base here was always small.
Is that a literacy thing, or is it just a...
It's a literacy thing, it's a financial thing.
Okay.
It's been an educational factor, and it's been a history of the fact that the newspapers largely catered for the elite.
Right.
And until the last 10 years, we never really had a popular... We never had much of a popular...
Okay.
printed media.
Okay, so you guys didn't have like tabloid culture and that type of thing in quite the same way?
Well, we had some, but not in the same way.
Okay.
Yeah, whereas, you know, our, you know, in 2002 they launched here a paper called The Daily Sun, which was a real tabloid in every sense of the word.
Right.
What the British would call a red top.
Yeah, yeah.
And that became very quickly our biggest newspaper by a long way, and remains our biggest newspaper by a long way. And certainly our biggest gap in our media market is the kind of small town or rural community newspapers. It's or community radio stations. That's where there's a great weakness. At the, I suppose the kind of bottom end of regular community coverage. There's huge gaps there.
Has there been a different impact or a more sizable impact on the Afrikaans press versus the English press versus, I guess you were saying that those are in terms of printing.
Look, the Afrikaans press was really a subservient government-supporting press that had cabinet ministers on its boards, and it really was close to the ruling party. And it's become stridently independent and critical. So the Afrikaans press has been through a radical transformation, yes. But, you know, there were two Afrikaans newspaper companies. There's now one. And, in fact, it's become a global developing world phenomenon. So one of the most extraordinary things is that NASPES, which was this very conservative Afrikaans ruling party supporting pro... not pro-apartheid, but close to the apartheid government newspaper group, is now a major player in China, in Brazil, across Africa.
What? How did that happen? They
went on a huge expansionist drive based on revenue they got from pay television. They struck it big in pay television. And very aggressive in new media. And therefore, the, you know, and the biggest shareholder, for example, in Tencent in China, which is a huge asset. So in the developing world, they're the leading group.
That's interesting. Mm. Here, as in the States, a lot of journalists, working journalists, feel a little bit downtrodden. I feel like there are a lot of people who are kind of not optimistic about where actually here where South Africa is headed and where South African journalism is headed. And so I kind of wanted to get your opinion on what you thought about either of those things.
Look, we have been going, we're continuing to go through a very radical and very difficult transition, you know, and clearly there's huge positives to that and huge negatives. And the society is, and our transition is more, we've come to learn, is more fragile than we thought it was. It's, you know, there's a country plagued by a deep inheritance of inequality and violence and conflict, which remains bubbling away beneath the surface and sometimes bursting out into above the surface. And our media has been through a very complicated transition as well. You know, and you put that transition together with what's happened globally, in terms of shrinking newsrooms, financial pressures, uncertainty about the future, digitalization and its complexities. That has led to a great deal of uncertainty. And in some ways, in some areas, a decline of our media. Am I optimistic about it? I guess I am something of an optimist. I think we have to be, I'm a realist about the transition and the complexities of it and the fact that we're going to have many ups and downs. We've had many ups and downs. We continue to have many ups and downs. People here love to say, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic? It's a ridiculous question because we're on a roller coaster ride. We have been for a long time, and we will be for some time.
Okay, well, we're back. We'll keep this short, but we do want to talk a little bit about what we just heard. So now, tell us what he was sort of wrapping up with there.
Well, he's largely positive, kind of has a optimistic or positive outlook about South Africa in general and South African journalism. You know, they have weathered relatively well, I tend to agree with him, a lot of transition. If we just think about in the U.S. what transition we've gone through with the digital revolution, if you add on top of that, you're a new democracy.
Right.
You have to integrate your newsroom. You have to deal with the fact that you no longer are living under this, like, really sort of overbearing censorship. You know, they have weathered a lot of things very well, I think. Things are tough. Things are tough in South Africa in general. Their unemployment's high. They are still the largest economy in Africa, but Nigeria looks like it will overtake them in 4 years. And that's kind of a big psychological blow to South Africans who have always thought of themselves. Yes. I mean, and that goes for, in my experience, all groups of South Africans kind of think of themselves as being kind of leaders in Africa, more developed, more sophisticated in some ways. So South Africa's having some economic troubles. Their government, a lot of people are not satisfied with their government. The president's going to be in office for 7 more years. Many people are not very happy with him. Unlike the U.S., anyone who knows anything about how the U.K. system works, that's more how they work. So you vote for a party. And in this case, President Zuma's party is the ANC, which is the party of Nelson Mandela and the party of liberation. They have a 2/3 majority. They win overwhelmingly for obvious reasons. But people don't necessarily like him. Mm-hmm. So it's like a lot of people are voting for the ANC, and he is the leader in the ANC, but they don't like the fact that he's the leader. They would prefer it to be someone
else. Well, that's like in America where you end up with two candidates you don't particularly like, but you're going to vote for one because he or she is the candidate
the
of your party. The lesser of two evils. And I do mean evil. There's a couple of interesting things that I took away from this. One, the obvious thing is that, you know, that not that we have a perfect world with all of the freedoms that we have with our press, but that we certainly have a lot of freedoms and a lot of lessons and experiences that we've had for 200 years of a free press. That, you know, this is a relatively new country that is dealing with, you know, building its own free press. I thought that was really fascinating that, you know, just – you know, it's day one, you know, what does it mean to have a free press and trying to define that from both the government's point of view, you know, what are we going to let the press do? And also the press itself in understanding, you know, what their role is and how they're going to fulfill that role. I think that was fascinating. And then also, I mean, broadband, the technology, just to see how much that affects the development of and spread of digital media. Just the cost of that, just how much in our country, you know, the cheaper broadband has sort of helped to push digital much faster than anywhere else than other countries.
I mean, you know, you have to in South Africa, 80% of the population is black, and of that 80%, about 30%, only 30% have a telephone in their home. Mm-hmm. So already you're looking at smaller numbers, because if you don't have a telephone in their house, if you don't have a telephone, you probably don't have an internet connection. Mm-hmm. You may have a mobile phone. You know, you're already looking at a much smaller segment of the population, and then it's just really expensive even for people who can, like, quote, afford it. And also, I mean, it's sort of like where we were. I would say, I guess it's hard to gauge, but like 10 years ago, I mean, you do not, it's not like everywhere you go, there's Wi-Fi.
Right.
So I used to go to lunch every day from my building. We were next to a big pedestrian mall. There's like one place in that mall that has Wi-Fi. Everywhere else does not have Wi-Fi, you know. And that's a mall that's sort of in the equivalent of like a Tyson's Corner situation. Like there are lots of like very wealthy business oriented people.
Yeah.
So it's just really different and frustrating.
Is there hope to change the price of broadband? Is that, I know that's maybe not like a under the journalism purview, but just in general to make that more accessible to people?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'll tell you this. This isn't exactly an answer, but because I was working for a financial publication, I went to a lot of meetings with a lot of business people and, you know, people who are heading up Johnson & Johnson in South Africa or all of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always surprised how that didn't seem to be coming up in the how can we grow the business
right.
world of South Africa discussion. Because to me, it was just a huge barrier. You know, they would talk a lot about skilled labor and you know, work compensation laws, a lot of those types of things. There's concerns that South Africa may be going in a more socialist direction in mm-hmm. terms of certain things. Having said that, I was always like, what about broadband? Because I don't know why anyone who's a high-tech person would want to open a
right.
company up here. And I had heard from other people who had traveled around Africa that places like Rwanda, probably with outside assistance, I would imagine, have great broadband and internet access. So I was sort of wondering, and that Nigeria has better broadband access in some ways. So I was sort of wondering, like, isn't this something you need to get on top of? Because, you mm-hmm. know, if I want to have my global office in Africa right now, the reason a lot of global companies have their offices in Joburg because it's more built up, you know, things work well. They don't have power outages as often as other parts of Africa. But at a certain point, the fact that your broadband is so expensive will be, mm-hmm. I think, an issue.
Mm-hmm. So, well, and maybe that's something an entrepreneur needs to do is to go in there and say, look, we're going to make this part. But then the other side of it is that they may have other, from their perspective, they may see other problems or issues that they're going to, you know, from a business perspective, might have a bigger bang for their buck. Or, you know, maybe they're just not, that's just not on the radar or it's not as much of a priority in general. I think this has been a really interesting conversation, and I'm really glad that you came in and brought in this audio. Did you want something you wanted to add?
I have one last question.
Okay.
So I'm curious, you guys talked a little bit about journalism education in terms of where he works, and I'm curious, what is journalism education like? I don't know if you can answer this question, but is it comparable to what we're learning here in the U.S., especially in terms of the digital push?
Yeah, that's interesting. I tried to get a little bit of a hold on that with my coworkers. So as I mentioned before, the university that he teaches at is a, like, second best university in the country. Some people, probably the best in certain fields. South Africa is a little bit different in that you tend to go to university, again, at least I know a lot like Ireland, kind of close to home. Journalists, not all of them go to university, much like it used to be here. Some of them go to it's hard for me to tell, they're kind of halfway between university and high school, something called like a technicon, which is essentially like a technical training school. And some of the reporters at Business Day went to a technicon. Incidentally, some of the best reporters, I would say of the reporters under 25, the very best reporter went to a technicon. So I don't know how that breaks down. I think this isn't quite answering your question, but I think their higher education system is also in flux. I don't know. I don't think that they're training them to do digital journalism. I don't think you see a lot of sort of web development stuff going on. That is the impression I get.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in. It was good talking to you. This is a really interesting sort of perspective. It's nice to get a look of what's going on with journalism elsewhere in the world. I know you're on Twitter. People want to contact you on Twitter. How can they do that?
Sure. I'm at J.S. O'Donohue. My last name's kind of hard to spell, so I'll say at J.S. O'Donohue.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of the media. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about us at itsalljournalism.com. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com. Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at All Journalism.